Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome to Inside the Hive. This is Joe Hagan. I'm here with Emily Jane Fox. Hello, Emily.
Hi. Good morning.
And good morning or good afternoon or good evening, wherever you are in America and the world. It is a week when we are seeing a new character emerge on the stage who we have not seen very much of.
Brand new character.
Weeks and months. He's like a fresh, you know, a spring chicken.
I actually don't know that anyone's ever used that phrase to describe who we're talking about. We're talking about Joe Biden, so spring chicken may not be exactly it, but it feels like a fresh face.
He's a fresh face. He's, I don't know, yeah, is he spry? Does he have a new spring in his step? Maybe all we can say about him is that he's there, he's appeared.
That's, honestly, that's more than we could have said 2 weeks ago, so being there, an improvement in the 2020 race for the White House. Joe Biden has emerged over the last few days to do what any candidate would have done in any half a day in the 6 months leading up to the election. But this year, with the world upside down as it is, it feels like a real novel movement worth talking about on our podcast because he has given two public press appearances. What a marvel, what a wonder, what a cause for pause in our news cycle.
Well, I both get excited about it and I get a little bit of tense when I see him talking. I feel like I'm out on the tightrope with Joe Biden.
What's making you tense about it?
Well, I want him, all the words to line up.
Sure.
And, you know, I want it to come out smooth. And I want to feel some level of, you know, that he's relaxed and he's got this.
What did you feel right when you saw him? Did you feel those things?
Well, there was the one clip where he says, you know, people are asking about his, whether he's mentally fit enough, whether he gets checked out, right? And for his cognitive capabilities. And he says, I'm excited to, you know, compare my cognitive capabilities to that of my opponent.
It was a good soundbite.
Yeah, it was a good soundbite. I felt good about that. And, of course, right after Trump's tried to create a narrative that this was a complete phony press conference in which all the reporters were somehow in on it and it was all scripted.
Eric Trump had a field day with that.
Eric Trump is... it's unbelievable that a guy who is unimpressive as him has a microphone in this country as large as he does.
Welcome to 2020, Joe.
Ouch. I mean, at least, you know, well, anyway, we don't have to get into all that. But yes, Joe Biden seems to be emerging. And I have been thinking a lot about Joe Biden and the concept of timing. I keep putting my own head into his campaign manager's head and thinking about, you've got to pick your moments to come out, right? I think this rope-a-dope thing that we've been talking about in recent weeks has actually been working. It is a thing that has worked for him. You know, let Trump be Trump and ruin his own polling and you sit back. But at some point you have to come forward, but you have to pick your spots. And this week he picked his spots with news that Trump overlooked or didn't know about the fact that the Russians may have been paying the Taliban to target and kill U.S. soldiers, right? And so I saw that was like a little bit of a surprise. Oh, Joe Biden's actually going to talk about that. And he went on the offensive on that subject.
Well, he has to. Like, this is an issue that every single person in this country, if it is true, should be outraged by. It's an issue that could potentially move the needle amongst members of his base that we thought were sort of immovable. It's horrifying if this is if this is true. And so my only thought over the last week is like, are Democrats going to be effective enough in messaging this? The message seems so clear to me, but Democrats are not the most effective in terms of their messaging and their ad making, particularly so over the last 4 to 6 years. And I just, oh, there's my dog. There's my dog. There she is. There that she is. She agrees. That's what she's saying is she agrees with me that the Democrats are not being effective. She wants to raise her voice and lend a hand to the Democrats making these ads and messages. I just think that there are endless possibilities of how they can message about this from now until November. The question is, are they effectively going to do that?
Right. And the you know, my theory, so, and I agree with him. I totally agree with him about everything he's saying. My informed, semi-informed theory is that this news actually probably emerged with the Bolton book and these military generals and leaders who have come out against Trump and worried about their own military, you know, their culture that they come from, you know, that here the Democrats have been handed a pretty significant piece of information to go after the president with, probably from people that are not even traditionally in their own party. We need Joe Biden to have the same level of bark and bite as your dog.
Barbara Walters, Fox Eisenberg, has a lot to say and a lot that Joe Biden could learn from.
Yes. So today, I'm bringing on a guest named Jake Tapper. Perhaps you've heard of him.
It rings a bell.
Yeah. He is the anchor for a show called The Lead on CNN. He's everybody knows that if you've ever flipped on CNN, there is a 98% chance you've probably seen him and know of him already. He is also, on the side, where he finds the time, I don't know, a novelist, right? And a writer of nonfiction books. And one in particular, The Outpost, was a book that he reported and wrote about one of the most kind of horrible and violent battles in the Afghan war, and about this platoon of soldiers who fought and lost many of their comrades in a kind of, you know, almost like Guns of Navarone, sort of like you know, the Last Stand sort of battle. And I saw the movie recently, and it was like a white knuckle, very stressful movie to watch, I must say. But in the course of that, Jake Tapper got to know these soldiers so well. They're friends of his now, so the ones who survived. And he has such an emotional connection to these guys whose story he told. And so when the news came over the transom that the Russians may have been paying the Taliban to go out into the field and kill these guys for money, and that Trump may have known about this for months and did nothing. Trump, the one that we have seen plenty of ample evidence to think that is in the pocket of the Russians. You know, this is significant news. Like we've been talking about, if, you know, Joe Biden could wield this, if he wielded it properly, would be, you know, very effective in letting people know what they should already know, which is that Trump is a horrendous leader and possibly a corrupt one and possibly a puppet of some kind. I mean, I don't want to be going to conspiracy world. You always feel like you are when you're talking about this, but the evidence keeps piling up. In any event, Jake Tapper is going to talk about that on this interview, and he's also going to talk about the media's role and, to some degree, culpability in, you know, propping up Trump. Trump loves attention. The media gives it to him. And Jake Tapper is on TV every day talking about Donald Trump like the rest of us are. And so, but we can't get out of this binary we've been trapped in. But the good news might be, as we're going to talk about here, is that maybe that symbiotic thing that we've been trapped in is starting to fracture and break, because the coronavirus is, as we've said in the past, now more famous than Trump. and we have to focus on our life and death news before we get to our dumb Trump news of the day.
Well, speaking of dumb Trump news and life and death news, do you want to get to the interview?
Let's go to the interview.
Wait, and, before we go, everyone just wear your masks. Everyone stay at home. What is happening now is no different than what happened in April. So don't behave differently than you would have at the end of March or beginning in April. Just take care of yourselves. Take care of everybody else. And listen to this great interview that Joe has done with Jake Tapper.
Please follow that advice. Jake Tapper, welcome to Inside the Hive.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
It's you're talking to us right now from your home in Washington, D.C. Is that right?
Well, it's my home and studio now, but yeah, from my house in D.C.
Right. And you're now doing your own makeup. Is that right?
Well, that's true. That is correct. I have, you know, when you're a correspondent on the road, you do your own makeup all the time.
Right.
You know, one is not to the anchor desk born. So it's not the first time I've ever done my own makeup. But it's certainly when I was younger, I needed it less. So
yeah.
Yes.
Were you a Kiss fan as a kid?
No, you know what? All my classmates were huge Kiss fans. Huge.
Yeah.
But I was an Elvis fan. So I went in a different direction. But I knew Gene Simmons, Paul Stanley, Ace Frehley, Peter Criss. I mean, I got a lot of information from my friends' fandom.
Right. I think that you being this must have been in the 80s, right? That you were an Elvis fan?
70s.
70s. Wow. Well,
I'm 51. So yeah. So like in the, I think he had died, and that probably helped.
Yeah.
Propel him into my life. But yeah.
That's a very interesting insight into Jake Tapper right there, ladies and gentlemen. You know, young, you were kind of makes you one of those like young old people. You know, you were like,
I think that's fair. Yeah, I think that's fair. I never really got into the punk scene. You know, all these people were going down to see Rocky Horror at the TLA in Philadelphia, and that had literally no appeal to me. Although I would go to the TLA to see, this is the Theater of the Living Arts. This is like a big art theater on South Street in Philadelphia. I would go there to see actual movies like Blood Simple or Rear Window.
Yes. Right. And you were something of a young cinephile. And I was interested to see that in your biography that you were a film student briefly at USC. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. After Dartmouth, I did a semester at USC. I really do love film. I don't know that I was really cut out to dive into the industry at that point as a producer or writer or anything like that. But I'm excited that I've come to it in a roundabout way later in life.
I was going to say, you've come full circle. It only took you, 30, 40 years, but you're good now. Well, listen, I watched the movie a couple days ago. Talk about it like a white knuckle viewing experience. I was like, I was very stressed out after I watched The Outpost, which is the movie that you had now a producer credit on. You wrote the book that the movie was based on, the 2012 book, The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor. Incredible acting in this by Scott Eastwood and this guy, Caleb Landry Jones. Can you tell me which character Caleb Landry Jones plays?
Sure. He plays Staff Sergeant Ty Carter, who was one of the two men awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions that day, October 3rd, 2009. Scott Eastwood plays a guy, interestingly enough, named Clint, Clint Romachet, who is the other guy awarded the Medal of Honor for his actions that day. And in fact, the Battle of Cop Keating, one of the most decorated of the war, it's the first time since the Vietnam War that two men were awarded the Medal of Honor, two live men, I should say, were awarded the Medal of Honor for the same battle. Black Hawk Down, there were two awarded it posthumously. But it's the first time since Vietnam that two guys from the same battle who were still living were given the Medal of Honor. It was a very horrible battle and a lot of death and a lot of opportunity for incredible selflessness.
Right. Well, this all comes out in the movie, and it's like, it reminded me a little bit of like, it's a classical war movie on one level. And on the other, it has a documentary feel to it as well. It reminds me a little bit of the Sebastian Younger, Tim Harrington, documentary about soldiers in a kind of remote outpost in Afghanistan. And the question you're asking yourself throughout this movie, every time a soldier steps out of his tent, you're like, don't do it, but is why are these guys here? Why are they in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by three mountain ranges and a river, and just sitting there? You can't, they're sort of there to kind of win the hearts and minds of the local Afghans, but it's kind of, they're opportunistic at best, but it's not, everything's unclear. Even to the soldiers themselves, they ask, why are we here? What are we doing? Nobody knows. Did you figure out what the answer was to that? Like, why were they there?
I did. First of all, that was the reason why I set out to write the book, was I wanted to know why these men were there, why these eight guys were killed. And everybody kept saying, everybody in the media and the military ultimately as well, said that there was no reason to put this outpost at the bottom of three steep mountains. Why were they there? And so I did set out to find that out. It's interesting that it reminded you of Restrepo by the great Sebastian Younger and the late Tim Hetherington, because it takes place not really that far from it. That was in the Korangal Valley, and this is maybe 20 miles, 25 miles away in a different province, but right next door in Nuristan province. The reason was because in 2006, when they set up Combat Outpost Keating, the goal at that point was counterinsurgency. And the goal of counterinsurgency is to make the Afghan people connected to the U.S. and not to the insurgents. And the way to do that was to give villagers new power plants and new roads. And that's the idea behind counterinsurgency. It's hearts and minds. It's winning the hearts and minds.
Right.
And in 2006, when they set up this outpost, and General, now retired general, but then I think Colonel Mick Nicholson was the guy in charge, they set up all these little outposts all over northeastern Afghanistan, which is right where near the Pakistan border, where all the Taliban were coming from, or many of the Taliban, I should say. And the reason that they did it at the bottom of steep mountains as opposed to the top is because most of the helicopters were in Iraq. And in order to have a base that you could resupply, you needed to have access to the road. And it was really just that simple. The helicopters were in Iraq because that was the favorite war in 2006. And so in order to set up these little bases in order to reach the Afghan people, which was the goal of the mission at that point, they had switched to nation building. They needed to be near the road. And I met the guy. I met people who helped pick out the location. And they felt, you could tell, very guilty about it. Right. The book actually starts, and the movie almost started this way, but then they changed it at the end. The book starts with an intelligence officer, and the book's nonfiction, it's true, warning his commanders, do not set up an outpost in this place.
Yeah.
A guy named Jacob Whitaker. Do not set up an outpost. And he war games all sorts of scenarios, and in every one, people get killed. Everyone gets killed. It seems obvious to us now, and I think that the military has learned, don't put bases at the bottom of steep mountains. Restrepo was at least halfway up the mountain. That's the reason.
I mean, you talk about the military, quote-unquote learning lessons. And even during the time when the whole country was paying attention to the Iraq and Afghan wars, when it was at the top of our news feeds, we knew, you and I are of a certain I'm almost 50. I'm close to your age, but like, I'm not quite as old as you, but we grew up with books about Vietnam, right?
Yeah.
Bright Shining Lie by Neil Sheehan, Dispatches, Michael Hare. These are books that if you're a journalist, you had to read these and you would have thought that we would have understood all of this. And here it was almost like, same thing all over again.
Well, exactly. I mean, and the same, what they used to say about the Vietnam War, that it wasn't a, 10-year war. It was 10 one-year wars in a row.
Right.
That is the same problem that they had and have in Afghanistan. The idea that because you're constantly rotating people in and out and there's very little institutional knowledge, people don't know what works, what doesn't work, and they just start wipe the slate clean and make a lot of the same mistakes over and over and over again.
Right. And the big, you know, the reason those journalists I mentioned were well known was because they kind of sidestepped the official story that people were getting in Washington and went and saw things for themselves often. And you had no real connection to war reporting in a real way at the time that you got involved in this story, right?
No, not at all.
And so tell me a little bit about, you know, you interviewed what, close to 200 people for that book?
Oh, more than 200 people, 225 about.
Right. I mean, that's an all-in sort of endeavor right there, you know? And you had to have had, it became a personal journey for you. You've said that it's the single proudest piece of journalism you've done in your life. I suspect that remains true. So, you know, tell me about the relationships that you developed with these soldiers and what was the sort of, you know, not having come from that culture or grown up or been in the military and maybe not known a lot of people in the military, what was the biggest revelation about getting to know these people?
Ooh, that's a tough question. It's true that this remains the single piece of journalism I'm proudest of. It was a real obsession of mine writing this book for years. From the moment I heard about the outpost being attacked, which was in the hospital recovery room with my wife, I was holding my son, Jack, who had just been born, literally the day before the attack, and somewhere in that week, holding my son, hearing about eight other sons taken from this earth was something poignant, and I can't explain it other than to say, I know it sounds corny, and I would question it if I heard it from somebody else, except I then spent years writing this book. And it started with reading everything I could about it, about the outpost, and there really honestly wasn't much. The Army did an after-action report that came out, I think, the following February, and I read that voraciously, the redacted version that was released to the public. And then there was an article in the Times based on some WikiLeaks. But other than that, there really wasn't a lot. And then so, you know, the guys after this horrible attack, the guys from 361 service members still had to do a full year in Afghanistan. So they'd only been there for a few months. So they went to the next, the closest place, Forward Operating Base Bostik, and did a lot of the rest of the rotation there. When they got back in June of 2010, I started cold calling them. First, I read an article about the mom of one of them, this woman, Mary Henry, whose son, Eric Harder, was there, and she was putting together a reunion. And I reached out to her, and then through her, got in touch with Eric, and then Eric put me in touch with a different guy named John Hill, and it just went from there.
Yeah.
But, you know, anybody who's written about the military knows the military is its own worst enemy when it comes to helping journalists tell their stories. Mm. I never got a list of all the soldiers who served there from the Army or from the Pentagon. I mean, I had to do it all myself. And you're right. I started from I'd covered, you know, troop rotations from the comfort of the North Lawn of the White House when I was White House correspondent for ABC News. And I'd been to Iraq and I'd done a short tour there as a journalist for about 2 weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks with ABC News right after Bob Woodruff and others were grievously injured. But I hadn't really done it. So it was just a massive undertaking. And I guess what I learned the most was just how much of a chasm there is between the 1% who serve and sacrifice. And it's not just the people who serve abroad, but also their wives and their husbands and their kids and their parents who just, you know, walking on eggshells every day until their loved one gets home. And just how much of a chasm there is between that 1% and the 99% of us, the rest of us, who don't really pay much attention necessarily, who, you know, don't really think much about the stuff in terms of sending troops here, sending troops there, and how much that chasm hurts both sides of the equation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that, you know, it would be impossible for you not to have developed kind of a an emotional relationship with some of these people. They're giving you these incredibly vulnerable stories about their own, you know, near-death experiences or the death of some of their best friends. I mean, and I imagine you're still friends with them to this day. I mean,
yeah, not all of them. Obviously, there are hundreds of them, but some of them are really, really good friends of mine that I talk to all the time, or text with or email all the time. Eric Carter, the first one I talked to, has stayed with me and my family. Wow. When he's been to DC. He's a good friend. Yeah, I'm in touch with a lot of them on Facebook and in the normal way one would be in touch with people. And some of these friendships are among the most meaningful to me. Yeah. That I have. When Rod Lurie, who's a West Point graduate and made the movie and really did an incredible job, I think this is his masterpiece. And I'm a big fan of his film, The Last Castle, with Gandolfini and Ruffalo and Redford. But I think this is his best movie. When I first met him, I said to him, you know, we're going to get these people involved in the movie, the troops and the Gold Star families, and they're going to become parts of your life the way that they're parts of mine. I don't think he knew what he was in for, but they are parts of his life now as well. And we had a special screening for the Gold Star families and some of the veterans last October around the 10-year anniversary of the battle. The movie was not 100% done. They were still doing CGI and sound. We had a special screening, and Millennium Films flew in a bunch of the Gold Star families from as far away as Alaska and showed them the movie because we wanted them to be a part of it and know what was coming out. And that was a very intense but very meaningful experience.
Yeah.
This is Inside the Hive.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We got to show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Is it bursting with energy or drained? How do you recharge it? Have you ever reflected on those questions? Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/hive today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/hive.
You know, given, you know, this movie really makes clear, you're very emotionally connected to them by the end of the movie, you know, and it really imbues them with a sense of, you know, dignity. You know, they're kind of rough guys. It's a frat house sort of environment they're in, but then when the pressure comes on, they become often cases heroic. Tell me what it was like for you when the news came out just this week or last week that, you know, Russians may have been paying Taliban to kill American soldiers. I mean, I can't imagine that information came to you as a cold piece of news information. To you, it comes to you as somebody who understands what that really means. What did you think, and what do you make of that news?
Well, it made me really angry. it doesn't surprise me that the Russians would be doing this, as U.S. intelligence is debating right now how conclusive this evidence is. I mean, the Russians have been intervening, disrupting, trying to hurt Americans for years there. I mean, they've been arming the Taliban, so it's not a surprise that they would then like throw some money onto the table. But then the president's reaction, I just think, you know, I asked John Bolton about it that morning, Sunday morning, I guess the story broke on a Saturday. And, you know, he just pointed out that President Trump's reaction was all about him.
Yeah.
He wasn't briefed. He didn't know. You know, now he's calling it a hoax or fake news.
Do you believe that?
Do I believe that he didn't know?
Yeah.
I believe that the information was presented to him, and I believe he either didn't read it or didn't remember it or didn't pay attention. I don't have a difficult time believing that. I mean, I don't think he's the most hands-on guy in the world and not the most detail-oriented. I think even his, with the exception of those paid to lie for him, I think even his fans would agree. But beyond that, I mean, even if it were true, I mean, the reaction I would have hoped would have been something like, you know, I don't remember, you know, I did not get this information, or I do not recall this information, or we're getting to the bottom of this information, but know this, if it's true, we will do everything in our power to punish those responsible. Know this, there's nothing I take more seriously than the lives of our men and women fighting abroad. I mean, just that reaction is so absent, but not surprising. I mean, if you read the Bolton book, there are parts in it where John Kelly, then the White House Chief of Staff, Marine General, whose son was killed in Afghanistan, who I can't imagine what he's going through right now.
Right.
That's honestly one of the first things I thought about is, oh my God, what is John Kelly thinking? But there's a passage in the book where he talks about how, in his view, in John Kelly's view, Trump doesn't care about these guys. He doesn't care about soldiers on the front lines.
Right.
Which is an incredibly damning thing for a White House Chief of Staff to say.
Yeah. And, you know, the irony, though, is, you know, these soldiers you depict in your book and that who are depicted in this film, you know, they have, there's a sense of decency and dignity with them. But the reality is that a lot of the military rank and file still support Donald Trump, who, you know, shows no respect or decency or dignity. I mean, and how do you square that? And has it changed in terms of, you know, just the people you talk to? You know, what's the status of that relationship?
Well, I mean, yes, you're right that a lot of people in the military lean right. But I mean, I would say, like, knowing now hundreds of troops, that it's also fair to say that they run the gamut from far left to far right to libertarian. Yeah. Although I don't disagree with your basic premise. I would say that as a general rule, officers tend to be a little bit more liberal than enlisted men.
Right.
And women. I think that people are not necessarily 100% up to speed on, I mean, I think people are living their lives and they're not in the weeds of day-to-day news the way that you and I are,
right,
or listeners to this podcast might be. And I would say that, you know, Donald Trump is going to get a majority of Republican votes in November. And I would imagine most, if not all of those people are people who say that they support the troops and, you know, just support a strong foreign policy or whatever. So I think the tribalism when it comes to politics is just very strong, whether it's left or right. To me, you know, when Trump attacked John McCain, and I understand that John McCain to a lot of conservatives was a heretical figure, you know, a liberal, even though he wasn't a liberal, but you know what I mean? But when he attacked John McCain for being captured, for being a prisoner of war, I mean, that's to me like when he crossed a line that I cannot understand, why anybody would express such a sentiment.
Why people would forgive him that on the right, where they're traditionally boosters of the military. I've never understood how they could get over that, but they've gotten over a lot of things, right? You know, so I've been thinking a lot about this recently, because we have this bombardment of news about coronavirus. There's spikes in illness in Texas, Florida, and states that have traditionally been conservative strongholds, and people wonder, you know, on Twitter and social media, when are facts going to matter, right, to certain constituents of Donald Trump's? And I was thinking about a couple of years ago, well, I saw the Carl Bernstein piece on CNN this week, which was pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. And I thought about Carl Bernstein and Woodward and Bernstein and how for journalists of our generation, you know, they were kind of the models for what was possible, that you could speak truth to power and change the way people thought and saw their leaders, right?
Yeah.
And now we've had like dozens of Watergate-like scandals. 2 years ago, the New York Times exposed all of the Trump family tax schemes that had been done over the years. It was this massive piece, right? It moved the needle not a whit, right? Do you see any signs that, you know, that might change now? I mean, are facts regaining any traction in this political discourse? And do you agree with that, that no amount of reporting seems to be able to change the hearts and minds of just American voters?
Well, I mean, it is dispiriting when you see polls that suggest that more people, more Republicans believe President Trump than believe, say, the CDC or the NIH. That said, I mean, I don't know that it has had no effect. I mean, President Trump is incredibly unpopular. His approval rating is very low. And, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in November. And certainly we've all learned from 2016 that don't even rely on the polls before the election returns come in, because who knows what's going to happen. But, you know, it doesn't look particularly good for him. You know, I see people challenging things that he says and does, people on the right. And I see, you know, very low approval for him nationally. I can't get my head around the idea that, you know, when I read people's Facebook posts or Instagram posts and I see people just mindlessly defending things that are indefensible.
Yeah,
I can't get my head around it. But, you know, this is a very politically divided nation and people are not inclined, nor are they particularly encouraged by some corners to think independently or try to consider the other person's point of view. And I think that's one of the things going on. It's not only a phenomenon on the right, it is also a phenomenon on the left. But right now, obviously, is more pronounced. And you can't, you know, there are people on the left, for example, who don't trust vaccines. And there are people, it's this idea, this phenomenon of young people, younger than old timers like you and me, packing bars, not wearing masks. That's not just conservatives in, you know, Tallahassee. I mean, that's liberals in Manhattan. It's all over the country.
Yeah.
So, I do think some of the behavior that is not tied to facts is nonpartisan. But that said, I mean, what you're talking about in terms of the anti-scientific, anti-factual viewpoint is very much so present on the right and dispiriting. Absolutely.
Well, and I'm also talking about what motivates you. I mean, you're somebody who talks about, you know, you have this respect for the truth. Let's find out what the truth is. And then day after year, you're bringing forth truth or what you believe to be true and holding people to account on cable TV. And the best you can hope for is it turns into like a, you know, a Twitter meme for like a day and a half. And then it doesn't move the needle. I mean,
but I don't know that I agree with that, though. I mean, first of all, the Twitter meme, that's not my goal, nor is it what I think.
No. And I'm just saying it's dispiriting. I mean,
right now we are doing, I feel, we are doing important journalism on my shows. And our ratings are really good. So people are watching that. Like, that's the only measure, but it is being rewarded in that regard. Right now, people are choosing to watch my show and not MSNBC or Fox in terms of our wins in the demographic. People in the key demo are watching our show. And I mean, and sometimes the work product itself is its own reward. And, you know, I can't hope for, my goal is not to have politician X defeated or politician Y elected. I mean, I know that the Biden people are not particularly eager to put him on my show either, because they suspect I'll ask questions that are uncomfortable. So, I mean, I just have to do the best job I can and hope that that is in itself a reward.
Well, I mean, that's where it gets interesting. The reason I brought up Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, I know you've known and met these guys, and
yeah,
you know, that we're not living in that 1973 world anymore, obviously. But, you know, it's been said that the media has a kind of symbiotic relationship with Trump, and that ratings are really the only needle that's getting moved. And, you know, I'm thinking now about that Jonathan Mahler piece from 2017, where he actually talked about CNN and Jeff Zucker, you know, having their ratings problem solved by Donald Trump, right? That the strange symbiotic relationship between Zucker and this president. And, you know, what do you make of that? I mean, do you have a critique of that? Or do you agree that there's a kind of inescapable issue there?
It's a very complicated issue, because, I mean, that Mahler piece also went into the fact that Jeff and Donald and President Trump had known each other for years, and that because of The Apprentice.
Right. That was true.
Yeah, of course. I think that first of all, I don't look at Donald Trump and think, oh, this is great for ratings. I mean, that just is not even remotely something that passes through my head. Oh, super. This is great. He just
you're inside of that. I mean, you're sort of, you know, a torchbearer for a certain kind of news delivery, a certain kind of reporting. You know, it's the mold of Edward R. Murrow. I mean, and you have, you know, sort of some cable instincts on how to, you know, deliver the news, but on some level, you're also sort of trapped in this larger thing.
We're all living in the United States of America with President Donald Trump. That's inescapable. I mean, I think that those people who see Donald Trump as the lead story every day, no matter what, are missing out on stories. He does not haunt my dreams. He does not.
But doesn't he?
No. But it's not like I think, like, for instance, since this pandemic began, I generally do not lead with President Trump, even if he has said something completely preposterous. I don't necessarily think, oh, that's the lead today. Quite the contrary, actually. We start almost as a default talking about the virus, doing updates around the country about what the status is, going to Sanjay Gupta, talking to him about the latest medical news. That's generally our A block. Quite often, we don't get to Trump until the C block, the third block in the show. So I guess I think that those who have viewed the news cycle only through the lens of Donald Trump is the be all and end all
out. Yeah, but the viewers have come as a result of that. I mean, that's the sort of like trap of the reality TV news world we're living in under Trump.
But I'm saying we're doing better now with the viewers. We're getting more viewers now
without leading.
Leading with Trump. I mean, sometimes we do. Like, I can't remember exactly if we led with him the morning or the afternoon after he suggested or mused about ingesting disinfectant. But I mean, sometimes I'm not saying we never will. I mean, obviously, sometimes it rises to the level of an A block. But yeah. That said, more viewers are coming now.
And maybe this goes
when we're not doing that.
Right. And maybe this goes to what I was saying earlier is like, you know, now that life and death may be the story rather than just everybody's outrage pro or against Trump. Maybe that has begun to change that symbiotic relationship. You know, one thinks or hopes and dreams.
I don't doubt, but just to put a period before you move on, because it sounds like you're about to move on to another topic. I don't doubt that if Joe Biden wins, and that's an if, ratings will go down.
Of course.
For everybody.
Yeah.
I don't doubt that for one second. But that doesn't affect how I cover anything.
This is Inside the Hive.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You know, the trend in the world and on CNN, frankly, for some people in your position, is to become a little more forward in the way they deliver their news and interview people and become kind of like liberal heroes, right? I mean, the truth is the pressure on people in the journalism business under Trump's time has been to become more to play to the polarization. And I know I think you've done a great job of not going there, but the pressure must be pretty high to feed that.
I think the pressure was the highest. First of all, I don't dispute your premise. I mean, if you look at the silly day-to-day rewards, memes, you know, mediaite tweets, little things that people outside journalism don't necessarily pay attention to, but are that, you know, that serve as like, you know, cookies that your mom might give to you after school. Those little day-to-day rewards are completely built around a system of rewarding, I don't know if I would call it liberal outrage, but anti-Trump outrage.
Right.
So absolutely. I think it was strongest during the Russia investigation. And I think that was strongest when, in my view, MSNBC was writing a bunch of checks that the evidence didn't cash, where they were basically saying this was going to lead to President Trump's downfall. He was guilty. Every single incremental development was treated
right
as if you know, like the arrest of the Cuban thieves in the Watergate hotel, Cuban burglars, I should say. And I think that there was a lot of pressure then, and that was, by the way, the time that MSNBC was huge in the ratings, and right. then the bottom fell out of that story and they sank.
Right.
But yeah, I remember feeling that pressure. It's not pressure. It's just seeing what the competitor who's beating you.
Yeah.
Is
well,
doing.
There's gravitational pull in that direction because that's where the audience, that's what they want to hear and see, right? In that
I
moment.
I think that's true. But at the same time, I also knew, and we kept our feet on the ground. I feel like that we did anyway. That we're going to treat this. We're not going to go anywhere where the facts don't go. And, you know, we can talk about with informed people, we can discuss the news, but I certainly thought that there was a lot of hyperventilating. I say that with the utmost respect on MSNBC that I was concerned about both as as a journalist, because I thought that that was irresponsible. And also as a competitor, it bothered me because it worked. But, you know, there are things, all kinds of things that people can do to get a short-term win. I mean, I see it in network news all the time. You can dumb everything down, not call a lie, not offend anybody, not take a risk of offending anybody, run kitten videos, and you can get good ratings on broadcast evening news shows. But that's not a long-term play.
Right. I would say that your contribution to the news era we're in is what Taffy Broadus or Ackner called the JTWTFF, right? The Jake Tapper WTF face, right? Which also was described in the Jonathan Mahler article I mentioned earlier. There's a line in there about Jeff Zucker had good instincts about your facial expressions, you know, getting them on camera when you were interviewing Kellyanne Conway or whatever. And the disbelief face, right? Which I'm sure comes naturally, but then, you know.
I'm not a good poker player.
You in the past have been lauded and awarded for doing presidential debates. Yeah. And I would take it that your plan this fall is to be a part of the coverage of election night, which all of that's going to be different than it's ever been before. Are you scheduled to moderate a debate this fall? What is the status of televised presidential debates?
I don't know anything about anything having to do with them. I'm watching Biden and Trump, the campaigns go back and forth about how many debates there will be and who they'll participate with. You know, I know that it's going to be very difficult considering how much President Trump hates vocally certain members of the media and certain news channels and newspapers to arrive at any sort of moderator that they'll think is fair, given the fact that the president thinks that Fox isn't fair enough to him, that One America News is the only reliable broadcast network. I have not heard anything. I've not been told anything. Obviously, I would be honored to moderate a debate. I've done some of them in the primary, but I've never done a presidential debate. But if it doesn't happen this time, I'm 51. I hope I get another shot.
What is your kind of relationship with the White House nowadays? Do they like you?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think I have a fine relationship with them. I mean, I think they think I'm tough, but I guess if you got sodium pentothal into them, they'd probably admit that I'm fair. Before the Trump era, people on the left thought I was a Republican. People thought I was some right-wing conservative.
I remember that, actually. I remember that.
Yeah, that I was a neocon. And that, because I was a tough reporter when it came, I covered Obama and I tried to be fair. And I did think that the media was soft on Obama. I mean, maybe understandably so, but given the fact that he was this trailblazing figure in some cases. But I did think that we weren't, as an institution, we weren't questioning enough. And it is weird for me in the Trump era for so many of the people who lauded me, not all of them, by the way, but so many of the people who lauded me to now call me like a left-wing hack or all this stuff. And it's just, it's bizarre because I don't feel like I've changed at all. But in any case, I think that my relationship with the White House is fine, and I guess we'll see what happens. I'm sure that if I were picked to moderate a debate, there would be a huge outcry from the right. I also think that in some future world, if I ever get to moderate a debate, a presidential debate, there would probably be a huge outcry from the left. I mean, I don't think the Biden people, for example, like I said, I don't think I would make their, top 10 list of people that they would like to have moderate a debate. I mean, because I think that they think that I would be tough on.
You've interviewed Biden before, right?
Yeah, I interviewed him once in the last, since he started running for president. I think once or twice.
Yeah.
I think I interviewed him once, right? Oh God, it all blurs together, doesn't it? I interviewed him once right after the peace plan with the Taliban was announced. And I asked him about it and I had to correct him on it because he wasn't up to speed on it. And then his second time, he coughed into his hand and I corrected him for that. So those are the two times that I remember. But I know there were more substantive questions there as well.
Right.
But those are the two I remember. But yes, I have interviewed him.
This is Inside the Hive.
Yesterday or this morning as we talk, it's a Wednesday in July 1st. Trump is tweeting that Biden just had a press conference in which all of the questions were prearranged, that the press was in on some kind of
It's a lie.
Yeah, it's a lie. I just want to we're confirming here with Jake Tapper of CNN that not true. That's false.
Well, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, Doug McElway, I think is his name. He reports for Fox. He used to be local ABC 7 channel here, local ABC affiliate. And he asked Biden a question about cognitive decline. I mean, basically it was along the lines of I'm 65 and I lose
I'm 12 years younger than you.
Like, do you get checked out for cognitive decline if you think that think that the Biden campaign were eager for a televised question about whether or not he gets tested out for his cognitive facilities? You know, and you got another thing coming, but I mean, they were not prearranged.
Right.
It's crazy. But, you know, but this is where we are right now, is that the president will just say anything.
Right.
He'll just make it up and it doesn't even register anymore. People won't even say anything about it because he just floods the zone with all these lies. And Maggie Haberman had a great piece on this a couple of weeks ago, asking whether or not the president's predilection for self-sabotage was ultimately just going to be what does him in.
Right.
Donald Trump could win in November handily if he just stopped this nonsense, I think.
Right. Well, that's what but now he would have to as soon as he begins to speak in some candid way, then he'd have to candidly deal with all of the terrible things he already said that were not true and the bad things he's done or irresponsible things he has not done. And so he has sort of he's trapped in a way with his base just feeding them this red meat. And
I mean, yes and no, I hear what you're saying. But on Earth 2, let's say, you know, where Donald Trump is capable of rising to this moment and doing everything he needs to do in terms of the coronavirus and the racial healing and this and that, as opposed to what he's doing now.
Right.
You know, a week worth of, I'm not, you know, that's history. I'm talking about the future.
Yeah.
That's history. I'm talking about the future. And reporters would give up.
Yeah.
They would.
Yeah.
You know what we're like.
Yeah. A week of that, yes.
A week of beating us into the ground with that's ancient history. You're like, it was 3 days ago. That's ancient history. I'm looking forward. Let's talk about how we fix the problem, the coronavirus, and we heal this nation. A week of that and everybody would move on. I mean, not everybody, but you could get away with it.
Well, and the tweet we just discussed, by the time this podcast comes out on Friday, nobody will remember it. I mean, and that's the world we're living in. So, and I am just impressed, Jake Tapper, that you, have the fortitude to keep wanting to do it. You know, I often think, like, I was thinking about this before I was going to interview you. You're somebody who's right in the front row of this sort of maelstrom we've been describing, this political news warped world that we've been living in for the last few years. And every day you're contending with it. You know, I would have to take a break, right? It's just so dispiriting to think that what you're producing For one, that the entire news cycle revolves around this guy, and then that no amount of information or news breaks or investigations that you can conduct, can move the needle. Because back to what we were saying earlier, I do think that partly we're in this business to move a needle of some kind, right? We want to have an impact of some kind, right? Ratings, okay. You know, that's good for the boss. But you personally, when you go to bed at night, it's got to be about something else, one thinks, right?
Okay, you want to know what it is?
What?
Because you really honestly, you're pushing me in a revelatory place. So okay. I'll tell you. I wrote this novel called The Hellfire Club, and it takes place during the McCarthy era. And one of the things I did when I'm writing this novel, and it's a DC thriller, is I did a lot of research about the McCarthy era. And this was always going to be the plan. But then obviously once Donald Trump became popular and then won, I played it up a little bit more, McCarthy and Roy Cohn, the connective tissue between
right.
Joe McCarthy and Donald Trump. And one of the things that really stuck with me when I read about this history, about this era, is that you get one shot to do it, whether you're a senator or a reporter or whatever. And when somebody in, 2200 or whenever writes a thriller or writes a nonfiction book about this era, what are they going to see that I produced? What are my kids, Alice and Jack, who are 12 and 10, what are they going to see when they in 20, 30 years look back to see what daddy was doing during this time? Was daddy being tough? Was he standing up for the right things? Or was he not? Or was he just kind of going with the flow? Because you're right, ratings don't matter. Nobody knows what Edward R. Murrow's ratings were. Nobody remembers what Walter Cronkite's ratings were. They just remember what they did and whether or not it made a difference or whether or not they remember it making a difference. Now, the truth of the matter is that Murrow was late to McCarthy. He didn't do his broadcast until March 1954, 4 years after Margaret Chase Smith, the senator from Maine, Republican, went on the floor of the Senate and gave her Declaration of Conscience speech. And the truth is that Walter Cronkite was not even particularly early on pointing out that the Vietnam War was a stalemate.
Right. Yeah. Late in the game, really.
He was pretty late too, but they're both heroes. I don't mean to diminish what they did.
Sure.
But the point is that somebody's going to go back and look, whether it's Alice and Jack or somebody I don't know or will never know. And I want to make sure that people understand that there were journalists standing up and saying that, a U.S. president telling four congresswomen of color, three of whom born in the United States, all four citizens, telling them to go back where they came from is abjectly, empirically racist. And I want to make sure that people know that there are people on TV, on news, saying that. Because I don't know who's going to win in November, and I don't know what the world's going to look like in 20 years, but I know that my kids can go back and look at how I covered that, and they'll see that I called it racist.
Jake Tapper of CNN, I want to thank you for coming on Inside the Hive today. That was a really illuminating conversation. I appreciate you engaging with these big questions today.
I need a drink.
We'll get that drink one day.
We should note that it's 10 o'clock at night when we do this, so it's not inappropriate.
Yeah, we're not going to do morning cocktails. Not yet. We're not there yet. All right. Well, listen, thank you so much. And we'll hope to have you on again. And I appreciate everything you've said today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor being here. It's a pleasure. I always love reading your stuff. So it was a lot of fun. And I do hope someday it will be safe for you and I to walk into a bar together and get a drink.
And that's our podcast this week. I'd like to thank Jake Tapper for coming on the show. And of course, my co-host, Emily Jane Fox. If you enjoyed this conversation, please listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive, which you can find, of course, on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Leave Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work, especially our producer, Bob Tabador. And thanks, of course, to my sponsors. Please support them the way they support this podcast. And we'll see you next week.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.